This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robert Dow producing, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Pleased you're starting your week with us. And our first guest of the week is veteran columnist and commentator Quinn Hillier, a man who has called Louisiana home for much of his 59 years on the planet, now lives in Mobile. He worked at the Mobile Press Register, at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and high places. Former press secretary to Bob Livingston, former managing editor at Gambit, columnist and editor at the Washington Examiner, and also a columnist of note now, again, with the Baton Rouge Advocate. And good morning to you, Quinn.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
I understand you've gotten a promotion recently. What's going on in your world?
Well, I am, I guess the title is deputy commentary editor of the Washington Examiner, which is... Which, when you're doing it from 1,000 miles away, I guess it's a pretty good thing. It's not often that you can get a sort of a top editorship from 1,000 miles away. So I'm pretty happy.
And this is a publication known for its conservative bent, and nothing wrong with that. There are, of course, many publications which I often cite known for their liberal bent, but. You have not been a fan of Donald Trump from day one when he opened his campaign for president the first time in Mobile at the old Ladd Field. And as we know, he won in 2016 and he lost in 2020, but he's back. And a couple of numbers over the weekend have to be encouraging for Donald John Trump. President Biden's approval rating, according to a CBS poll, is at 41%. And in a race that would match the two of them, conducted by a Harvard-Harris poll that was released on Friday, Trump 47, Biden 40. And among the Republican presidential aspirants, Trump 58, DeSantis 16, Pence 4, Haley 4. So is Donald Trump, until further notice, the leader in probable nominee for the Republican Party?
Until further notice. Keyword. yeah, he's got a big advantage. That doesn't mean that he will be the nominee. So many people, every single presidential cycle, assume that the front runner is going to be the guy that ends up getting the nomination. And it's often, quite often, quite wrong. At this time, 8 years ago, you never would have predicted that Donald Trump would have been the nominee. At this time, or about 2 months later, back in 2007, but, you know, mid-summer of that cycle, John McCain was dead in the water, and he ended up getting the nomination. I could go on and on. So there's lots of things that can happen between now and next year.
There are. But he's way ahead among the Republican contenders. And I think you would acknowledge, Quinn, that there has never been a phenomenon, to my knowledge, on either side of the spectrum like Trump. And when people, I think we had someone on, I know we did the other day, who said that Trump supporters have to have a screw loose to be in favor of him after all of this. And here's a man who, civil court a few weeks ago, as we know, all but convicted him of rape in a New York department store, sexual assault. But these people who are for him, many of them, as you know, are pillars of the community. They're good people, and they like him for whatever reason. And it seems that he has a loyalty that he once said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. I'm not sure that his support can be budged from those who like him and like him a lot, and that may be enough to at least get him the nomination. And with a weak Democrat running against him, who knows, Quinn Hillier?
Well, yeah, and that should actually scare everybody who is still reasonable and rational, because the man is a menace to society. He is flagrantly dishonest. Flagrantly corrupt. He is completely, utterly unstable. Look, if you have one former aide who's disgruntled, who writes something, you know, that says this guy is sort of off the wall and you know, and bounces off the walls. That's one thing. If you have all sorts of people who for decades have earned respect and trust, who all, when they leave the administration, they all write the same thing. They all write that he's unstable. They all write that we're very lucky that we escaped his first 4 years without some major disaster happening. When they all say that, you got to start listening. This guy is not stable, and it's not safe to have him as president of the United States.
877-217-5757 is your number, and your email, if you're so inclined, is talk@talklouisiana.org for Quinn Hillier. Well, at this point, and we're 17 months from the election, 17 months and a few days, and we're just over a year away from party conventions, who would be the most likely Republican who could gain the traction to take the nomination from him?
Well, the obvious, most likely alternative right now is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. What I think other candidates are hoping is that Trump and DeSantis destroy each other. Look, I've seen this happen before when the two front runners get so nasty knocking each other down and are so effective smearing each other that the Republican electorate looks and says, okay, pox on both your houses, and they elevate a third one. I've seen it happen in a governor's race in Alabama in the last 15 years. So people like Nikki Haley, like Tim Scott of South Carolina, who is announcing today, or like Mike Pence, are hoping that those two front runners just absolutely destroy each other. And if so, maybe one of those others will get a look. And frankly, they all deserve a look because they're all substantive people who have actually accomplished a lot of good things.
And a listener notes that Democrats, for the most part, they want to win, of course, and Trump is the most beatable, probably, of all the Republicans. Maybe the only Republican Joe Biden could beat, and the only Democrat that, well, I don't know, there might be a few others, but right now Trump is 7 points ahead of Biden. Is that just...
Well, there was...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just going to say that there was a poll out just a week ago that said just the opposite, that had Biden 7 points up on Trump. I think the biggest point you made is that, in a sense, Biden is the only one that Trump can beat, and Trump is the only Republican that Biden can beat. Both parties are sort of putting everything they have at risk with their potentially weakest candidates. If the Democrats nominate, say, a Mitch Landrieu of New Orleans or even Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, they'll destroy Trump, but they might not destroy Tim Scott or Nikki Haley. Vice versa, if the Democrats put up Biden, then Republicans, if they have Scott or Haley or Pence, they'll destroy Biden because Biden is not showing very well, and he's very unpopular, and I think for very good reason. So, again, both parties are really sort of being stupid here.
All right. Well, I'm looking at some of the recent polls, and the one from Harvard has Trump ahead by 7. Yahoo on May 10th had Biden 45, Trump 43. And then there was one I know last week, and I'll find it if I can locate it from The Economist had Trump 44, Biden 42. So 7 points seems to be an outlier. But right now, despite all his woes, Donald Trump is not only the front runner for the Republican nomination, he is a slight favorite, if you will, for the presidency of the United States. And remember, here's a guy who's not gotten a plurality of the vote either time. He lost to Hillary Clinton by 2 percentage points, but yet he still won the election in the Electoral College. Daryl in River Bend. Daryl, you're on with Quinn Hillier.
Jim, you know, one of the things I've always said, you know me very well, when somebody say you have a screw loose because you support somebody, man, look at the policies of this damn country where we are right now. Look at your border, look at your interest rates, look at your competitive edge. We're talking about policies. You are talking about personalities. Talk about the policies of this country and where we are today as a people and as a country. And then because the personality, yes, he's narcissistic. Anybody who knows Donald Trump knows he's narcissistic. But same as Biden. How can you do what you've done in this country as the vice president of the United States and don't talk about it. If that's not narcissistic, what it is? So when you talk about supporters of anybody, it could be Democrats or Republicans. Give the people the respect. You vote in their pocketbooks, man.
All right. That's Daryl Glasper. Quinn, I'm sure many Republicans listening to this show, and there are more than a few, are saying, amen, Daryl. that's the mantra from the Trump camp.
Well, exactly, except both Biden and Trump actually have, I would say, terrible records in office. And I don't know how Trump gets away with saying that he was so great on, say, even his signature issue of immigration. Here are the facts. Donald Trump, there were more people, more illegal
migrants. All right, well, hold that thought. We are going to pick it up right after this 90-second pause. We'll get Quinn Hillier on Trump and immigration. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and in a few moments we'll hear from Stan Harris, the president and CEO of the Louisiana Restaurant Association, on the comeback from COVID. But as we hit the break, the conservative columnist Quinn Hillier was stating that Donald Trump, even on his signature issue of immigration, has some holes in his argument that he was a panacea for border problems. Why is that the case in your view, Quinn Hillier?
Well, it's not view. It's a fact. There were more illegal immigrant encounters, official statistics, in Donald Trump's 4 years than there were in either of the two previous terms of Barack Obama. Let me repeat that. More illegals crossing in 4 years under Trump than in the previous 4 years under Obama or in the previous 4 years of Obama before that. Therefore, Donald Trump was not that successful on immigration. How about spending? The number one issue for the last 80 years for Republicans has been government spending, keeping spending down, keeping deficits down, keeping debt down, not even counting the pandemic. And even after taking inflation into account, Donald Trump was the single biggest spender in U.S. history, except, of course, for World War II. So biggest peacetime spender in history, way bigger than, yes, uber-liberal Barack Obama. I could go on. When you actually look at the results from Trump, the numbers are not good for him.
The White House and House Republicans wrapped up another round of debt ceiling talks yesterday. Washington is racing to strike a budget compromise and a deal to raise the national borrowing limit and avert what is being termed as an economic wrecking federal default. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden spoke by phone. They are talking. They're set to meet for a pivotal meeting today at the White House. What's going on in your estimation, Quinn?
Two sides acting like idiots. Look, it is not a good idea in general to use the prospect of the entire U.S. government being in default in order to make gain political points. On the other side, this has been done again and again and again. I think 7 of the last 10 times that the debt ceiling has been reached, they have had to have some sort of side agreement to cut spending or in order to raise the debt limit. So it's absurd for Joe Biden, the president, to say, well, no, I'm not going to negotiate at all, which is what he did until 2 weeks ago. It's equally absurd for Republicans to say we want every big or almost every major spending reform that has been on our plate, we want it all in this one package. Again, you're talking about the default of the government of the United States. Both sides need to get in and say, okay, we're not going to get everything we want. Let's have some spending restraint and then pass a temporary hike in the debt ceiling, and then come back and argue some more.
Congressman Garrett Graves of Baton Rouge is a top mediator in these talks. He is extremely close to Speaker McCarthy. It is a notable accomplishment for the state of Louisiana. And after all, Steve Scalise is number two behind McCarthy in the House leadership. What do you make of our state having such a profound place at the table?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. For decade after decade, except for very short intervals, Louisiana has had some of the top members of Congress, both House and Senate, in the country. Somehow we produce very able and effective politicians. You know, you go back to Hale Boggs and Lindy Boggs. You go back to Bob Livingston and Billy Tozan, John Breaux. You go back to Russell Long. Louisianans have played an outsized role because they send people up there who know how to get things done. And that's what I'm arguing in favor of, is let's have a sense of how do we get something done? How do we get to yes, rather than how do we stamp our feet and make the most noise? And Garrett Graves and Steve Scalise are both in that mold of, hey, you know what? We're very strong conservatives, but in the end, let's get something done that moves the needle a little our way rather than put everything at risk and lose everything.
Quinn Hillier, always good to talk with you. Thanks for your insights, and we'll be calling again soon. Appreciate you.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate it.
All right. We're joined now by Stan Harris. He was chosen by the Louisiana Restaurant Association as president and CEO in 2010. So he's now been large and in charge for 13 years. He's logged over 30 years in leadership roles in the restaurant industries, starting here in Baton Rouge with Tom Moran. And we know him as a fixture for some time at Chris's and Ruffino's and at TJ Ribs and at Ninfas. He knows the lay of the land well. And over the last 3 years, he's been with us every now and then. It's probably been about a year. And as we know, COVID struck the industry mightily. But there has been a comeback, and he's with us to talk about how substantial that comeback is and whether things will get even better in the years to come. It is a state, as we know, our state, which relies heavily on this industry, perhaps more heavily per capita than any other state in America. And good morning to you, Stan Harris.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
How's it looking?
Well, I think that we're seeing some bright spots around the state, and we're still seeing some challenging areas when it comes to, you know, getting people back in the workforce, which is, a sea change from what happened in the early days of COVID, and the industry basically shut down. So we're rebuilding. You know, you've seen some brands and some operators close, and people, you know, that might be a first-generation operator that's at the end of their life cycle get out of the industry. But we've seen a lot more people looking at coming into it. So that's always exciting to see folks that believe they've got a better concept, that they can do it better, that they have better food, and that they know how to run their business better. So for us as a trade association, it's never a time that we can be resting on our laurels. It's always how do we help our industry move forward.
877-217-5757 is your number for Stan Harris, Louisiana Restaurant Association President and CEO. As far as volume of business, are we where we were in 2019, or do we still have some ground to make up?
I think we still have some ground to make up. Some of our industry did really well through COVID, the fast casual and the quick service industry, and those that could really pivot to a delivery model or a drive-through model. It's our full service operators that are still trying to recover. Many of them had to go into debt to keep their business operating during COVID, and those debts now are coming due. So that's going to have to change their model. And of course, we've dealt with ungodly inflation and some supply chain challenges and shortages and things that we probably haven't seen in our country since World War II.
It is a case in which this industry is symbolic of Louisiana. If one were ever to go down, we wouldn't want this one. And in the larger cities, of course, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and others, Lafayette, the restaurant industry, it's symbolic of the culture, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And when you look at the restaurants that in the cities that you just mentioned, or any of the areas around the state, people have an immense amount of pride about how they prepare food and what it is that they prepare. You know, we've been going through challenges since Hurricane Ida with our seafood harvesters and shrimpers and oystermen and commercial fishermen, who so many of them lost infrastructure and the capacity to help us replenish that demand. That's always a challenge in trying to figure out how to balance it, because when people come to Louisiana, they're thinking first about not just what they're going to do or what they're going to see, but they're thinking about where they're going to eat. One of the service marks that we've trademarked is "We Live to Eat." It's one of the few places that while you're having lunch, you're thinking about where you're having dinner. So it makes you Louisiana somewhat unique.
Again, 877-217-5757. We do have to take a break, but we will go to the phone lines with Stan Harris, President and CEO, Louisiana Restaurant Association, and we'll start with John in Broadmoor. And Stan has a story to tell. He's a three-decade veteran or more in the industry, and he has an update on where we are now and where we're going. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. We're visiting with Stan Harris, President and CEO of the Louisiana Restaurant Association, a post he's held for 13 years. John in Broadmoor. John, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. I agree. We have some wonderful food in Louisiana. I sure wish that we could have a little more diversity in quirky foods. I'm going to call three restaurants that have long since gone out of business that were my favorites: Mop's Meat Pies, Danvers Roast Beef, and Copeland's Wrap and Roll. And I miss those. And no one has filled the void in those areas. And I'm just wondering why that doesn't happen.
Stan?
Well, you know, if you look back at it, if these were financially viable, they not only would have lasted the course of time, but they would have also expanded. And Copeland's has been an innovator for years, going back to before they started Popeye's Chicken and all they've done in that particular business, and with their cheesecake factories and things of that sort. So they've really continued to evolve and try to find opportunities to succeed. But I remember when Mary Olive opened Mops on Government Street, it was something that I looked forward to, because it was kind of bringing a taste of that Lazione's meat pie from Natchitoches down to Louisiana, down to Baton Rouge. We didn't have anything like that when it started.
Again, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org for Stan Harris. And a listener notes that in a previous appearance on this program, you noted how well in these high-end places like Chris's, how well the wait staff do. They make a lot of money, and I see this in large cities. I know in Atlanta, for example, a lot of people working in those restaurants and hotels, they have college degrees, but they find value in their work, and of course they find the value in their paycheck. And I know the minimum wage is lower than the actual minimum wage for people who work in restaurants, but in some places, in fact, you say many, Stan, the staff that serves does well.
Well, if people are presented with the economic opportunity as they are under our current model in the United States, where guests have been part of providing a gratuity through many, many years, I think that at the full service level, it's something that people are expected, and it's creating part of that experience. That service person is really part of that, whether it's recommending wine, whether it's recommending food on the menu or off the menu, things to create that whole memorable experience. That's the one thing that we talk about in the industry that I don't think other industries can do really well, is create those historical memories. And people come to restaurants to celebrate. Right now, we're going through graduation and prom season. We've just finished Mother's Day, probably one of the biggest dining out days of the entire year. And then we'll get into the summertime when people are coming here for leisure travel and things of that sort. So, you know, the restaurant industry is trying to figure out right now how to use innovation. We see that some of our quick service people are looking at artificial intelligence to be able to run call centers and take orders and run their drive-throughs. We're seeing automation. City Hospitality Group there in Baton Rouge used some robotics and some autonomous robots to at least have that conversation of how they could back up their service team. So these technology investments are things that people are going to do. The wages in the industry have moved because of demand in the market and because of opportunity since COVID began, and we're glad to see that. And we've always felt like mandating wages is not the best way to get people the circumstance. It's the market delivering on people having the desire to work and also creating that competition so that they can make more money.
And you speak as one who you didn't start as an owner. You started from the ground floor, didn't you?
Absolutely. Started, as I say, breaking dishes instead of washing them. I had to learn that you can't put stemware in with plates. But, you know, one of the things that we deal with right now, we're spending a lot of time at the Capitol going through this legislative session. I speak to a lot of business groups, and when I speak to them, I always talk about the fact, you know, how many of you feel like government should be able to raise its revenue to meet its priorities, and a lot of hands go up. And then I ask the next question, how many would you like to pay higher taxes and fees? Well, no hands go up, and we explain to them it's the same thing. So, you know, this surplus that we're talking about, this $2.2 billion, while it's a huge amount of money, it's because we've generated more through productivity and generating more in income taxes, but we've also had this 0.45 cent of sales tax on for a period of time that's generated these extra dollars. So I hope that our members at the legislature, at the Capitol, are going to be judicious in how they invest these monies and help us deal with some of the infrastructure things that we're probably somewhat behind on.
Are there any particular bills in the offing at the Capitol that you're following?
Yeah, we typically follow the things that have direct impact on our business, you know, unfunded mandates, restrictions on how alcohol is sold or licensed or managed. And, you know, we're doing some things. We have an emerging industry here with craft brewing, craft distilleries, trying to create some ability for them to have some events and get people to understand that these businesses are operating in a highly regulated environment, but we're trying to get them a bit more exposure. And it's challenging because you're going up against national and sometimes international brands and trying to create something. And, you know, we had a brand over in Lacassine in the Lake Charles area a few years ago that was sold to an international spirits company. And I think that got people thinking, wow, I could be the next one of those. And I think we've got some great product that's produced here in Louisiana. But, you know, we get back to it. We produce great coffee here. We produce great rice dishes. We've got a great ag business that supports all the things we do in the restaurant industry. And it's interesting and positive to see more of these local type ag businesses and product businesses have an opportunity in our Louisiana restaurants.
877-217-5757 for Stan Harris, President, Louisiana Restaurant Association, Ray in Prairieville. Ray, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thanks for taking the call, Jim. Always enjoy listening. The only question I have for Mr. Harris is, how can we encourage more salad-type, vegan, vegetarian-type of restaurants, more offerings? We just get a salad as a tenth option on after sandwiches and stuff like that. But how could we encourage opening outside of just we've got to buy more stuff? I'll take my answer on the air.
Thank you, Ray.
Well, I think when you look at segments of the market, I just returned from the National Restaurant Association show in Chicago over the weekend, and I look at things that are emerging, and you see that whether it's a vegan option, whether it's gluten-free options, these things didn't exist on menus 10 years ago, and they are definitely a large part of the full-service restaurant and the quick-service business today because people are looking at what they're eating. If there is a market to be able to generate a large number of salad-based or soup-based or vegan-type restaurants, someone will come and fill it. We look nationally. I track a lot of national publications and websites on the industry, and we see startups of these, but typically for us in Louisiana, we're not we're not typically thought of as the place that's the innovative part of food service and creating these types of healthy brands. I'm not saying that we wouldn't support them. I'm just thinking because of the size of our cities, we're not one that typically does that. You know, when we compare ourselves, we always like to compare Louisiana to Houston, to Texas, and always ask, how many cities do we have here that have more than 1 million people? None. How many do we have that are more than 500,000 people? We really don't have any. So we fight above our weight class pretty well here in Louisiana, and we like to create concepts that have a better than average chance of succeeding. And I do think that we're going to see more evolution of menu offerings over time.
How has inflation affected the industry?
Well, I think everyone sees it in their guest check. I think they see it when they go to the pump at the gas station or they go to the grocery store. All of those costs have rolled up into the restaurant industry. Our cost of paper goods, our cost of transportation, while poultry has come down a little bit, beef and pork have not. So those center of the plate items. And again, one of the challenging parts with this is tying the timing of the market for our seafood harvesters to when we have highest demand. Because people like to buy fresh before they like to buy frozen or further processed. So we're fighting those challenges. I think you've seen probably a 15 to 25% inflation factor. Some of that's driven by wages. Some of it's driven by occupancy cost. And another area that we're seeing right now is in insurance. Commercial property insurance for those businesses that operate below I-10 are just really challenged right now.
Stan Harris with us for a bit longer. If you'd like to get in under the wire, talk at talklouisiana.org and 877-217-5757. I think it's worth a mention. A listener asked me to ask you about Dale Brown. He and Tom Moran, his dear friend and your former boss, they were mentors for you, weren't they?
No question about it. I was very fortunate in my life to spend a great deal of time with TJ and earlier on with Dale. I was looking at something on my desk the other day, and the first item that Dale ever gave me, I was in junior high, and it was his first year here, and it was a coin purse, a rubber red coin purse that had a image of Dale and Jack Shallow and Homer Drew on it, and their schedule on the back of it. I don't think people use coin purses today. I date myself a bit. But going back to those people in my life, TJ passed away 8 years ago last week, and they had a large outsized impact on, if you look at Baton Rouge and you look at the LSU community, I think that there's really not anyone that didn't want that community to get better. I look back at Mr. Manship and all of what he did and leading the paper and the TV station, the radio stations. He was all about how do we make our community better? How do we make it more vibrant? And I still think we're fighting for those things today.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Stan Harris, and then we'll have an education authority, Ellen Broughton, with us. Your number is 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org back after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with Stan Harris, president of the Louisiana Restaurant Association. On deck is Ellen Broughton. Dr. Broughton has a compelling book, Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less, How to Rekindle Your Child's Motivation. Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, please be concise. You're on with Stan Harris.
Yes, I have visited places that have outlawed sub-minimum wages and have a $15 an hour minimum wage, and their restaurants are booming. You know?
All right. What about the argument about paying people higher than the required rate is stated? In some of these places, you get huge tip money, but that's not always the case.
Well, we've seen in the states, and there's seven of them that have outlawed the tip credit wage, and that's what it is. It's a credit for the amount that's replaced by tips. And those that have had this imposed have seen their gratuities go down as wages go up. And it's a market-driven thing. So, you know, for us, we typically, as an advocacy association, we fight on behalf of our members and our industry to want to do what's best for them. You know, when we have these hearings at the Capitol on these types of issues, typically there's no one from the tipped wage side that's coming to talk about this. It's folks that are from other groups that are there purporting that they represent them. Look, our industry's gone through a really, really tough time. We faced with the most significant restrictions during COVID for our restaurants, our bars, our music venues, and there wasn't a whole lot of relief. You know, as I like to say, payroll protection program was basically a loan, and if you did the right things with it, you got to forgive the loan, but it really just kind of helped you hold on for a period of time. It didn't help you cover the losses, and it didn't help you cover a lot of your costs. So it's been a very, very difficult time, and we always get into a conversation about wages and things. And the point with me is that people have an option when they go to work somewhere. And I'm fond of telling folks, if you need a large array of great benefits, maybe that you need to be working for a national restaurant company or national hotel company or someone like that that might have those things. Because the guy that has 25 employees that's running that mom and pop business, they're probably not going to be able to offer you that. But what they will offer you is a consistent job, a consistent paycheck, and the chance to learn and grow.
Stan Harris, always good to talk with you. Thank you, and keep up fine work. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Jim.
With us now is Dr. Ellen Broughton, Executive Director of the Learning and Emotional Assessment Program at Massachusetts General. She's also Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School and the Visiting Professor at Charles University in Prague. She is an internationally recognized authority on neuropsychological and psychological assessment of children, and her book is Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less, How to Rekindle Your Child's Motivation. And good morning to you, Dr. Broughton.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
And you get right to the point. Chapter one is, why doesn't my bright kid seem to care about anything? Is this a common woe for parents?
It is a common experience for parents. And I noticed in my clinical work that I was seeing more and more of it over the last few years. And in 2019, I decided to write a book about how we can kind of get those kids motivated and understand them better. And then the pandemic happened. And what I have been seeing since then, and it's getting a little bit better, but really during the pandemic and immediately after, a lot of unmotivated kids, a lot of kids who had been through a lot of losses and just really got off track, and their parents too. So it is a common problem, and it's something that I think a lot of families are grappling with.
You contend, and I think it's common sense, but perhaps not thought about as much as it should, that parents and others close to children, but particularly parents, they should know their child's strengths and, like, what does your kid enjoy? What is he or she good at? What is he or she persistent when it comes to pursuing knowledge? These are ideas that, as I state, must seem to be common sense, but nonetheless perhaps are neglected.
Exactly. I think when we have an unmotivated child, or even when we're feeling unmotivated, and I've had a lot of parents read this and say that they got a lot out of it in terms of their own experiences, is that we kind of lose pleasure. We don't remember the sort of things that made us excited about doing things. And we don't even think about, you know, how is it that we want to fill our time? So a part of the book really discusses each one of those things you just mentioned. It's to sort of explore the issue of kids who don't really care much from a number of different vantage points. And you know, we need to start by identifying the problem, but then also the solutions really depend on putting that sort of like, what are we good at? What are my aptitudes? How do I use that to get back the pleasure that I'm missing? And then sort of really thinking about our expectations and putting those issues of aptitude and, you know, what gives us pleasure, what do we like doing in the first place, connecting those to motivation.
A listener asks about this, and it is in your book. It's a comprehensive book, and it is, again, Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less is the title, but about depression. Many children, many adults, but particularly kids who are depressed are probably going to have challenges in school. What are some signs that children are not where they should be as far as their outlook on the world?
Yeah, this is a great question, because what we're talking about in not being motivated or not caring, it can then start to creep into depression. And most kids with depression, one of the symptoms of depression is that sort of lethargy and that sort of unmotivated kind of feeling. So the things you want to look for in terms of whether or not your child is actually depressed and not just unmotivated is you want to look for differences in their behaviors in terms of eating and sleeping. Are they eating too much, too little, sleeping too much or too little? Have you seen problems in academic performance or differences in their friend groups? Have they lost their friends? Are they not communicating with other people like they used to? You also want to look at their feelings. Sometimes in kids, depression doesn't necessarily look like the sadness that we have, especially in young boys and adolescents. They get irritable. So if you've got a child who's really irritable as well as being demotivated, of course, obviously feelings of sadness and depression, but also even feelings like low self-esteem, feeling inferior to others. A little bit of that is okay. Constant chronic feelings like that can be an indication of depression.
How can teachers assist in determining a child's strengths and challenges?
So one of the things you want to do as a teacher is to acknowledge those. You know, I'm a psychologist. When somebody comes into my office, I'm always looking at, you know, what do we need to fix? And teachers are like that too, and that's okay. That's part of our job. But our expectations, teachers' expectations, really need to match the child that they're seeing. And so you want to make sure as a teacher, you're spending some time talking to each one of your students about the sorts of things that they are good at and whether or not your expectations match what the child is able and competent to do. You also want to make sure that the child has everything they need in order to mm-hmm. be able to feel competent.
And you're big on setting goals, aren't you?
Goals are very, very important. So in the book, I really do talk about the things that we've just mentioned, understanding ourselves, knowing what gives us pleasure, what we're capable of doing. But then we also then need to put that into practice. And so I do spend quite a bit of time talking about how to make good goals, what we should expect from setting goals, and engaging your child in goal setting. That's also important. So you need to even do things that, you know, goals should be specific. They should be things that are mm-hmm. developmentally appropriate, meaning that it's not something that a child of that age can't do. And they also need to be, you know, achievable and time-based, and you need to revise them. Goals are something that are, you know, we put it down to say, all right, this is what we're heading towards. But almost always goals need to be changed. And I feel like that's where some families run into problems, is that they set goals, sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they're too lofty, and they are disappointed when they don't happen, and that can really result in feeling like, I might as well not bother, and that is a source of you know, becoming demotivated.
Dr. Broughton says make the goal tangible and notes that being a billionaire is not a goal, it's the result of many goals. I like that.
Exactly. Exactly. And I also hear from parents too a lot where they'll, you know, their goal is, well, I want my child to be happy. Well, again, happiness is one of those things too that is the result of good goals. It's really not a goal in itself. We want to be happy. We've got to figure out, well, what makes us happy? And what do we need to do? How do we need to arrange our life so that we feel we're able to do that sort of, you know, we're able to manage that goal? And so we've got to break off those chunks. And I do see a fair number of parents who come to my office who think their child is going to be the next Bill Gates or Steven Spielberg because they've done a great TikTok video. And kids feel this sort of pressure. And so, you know, they're like, I can't do the things my parents are thinking I'm able to do. I don't even have the knowledge. I don't have the tools in order to do it. And so they kind of give up. And everybody then in the family is disappointed. So we have to watch our goals. We have to, you know, watch the sort of expectations we're putting on our kids and be willing to say when they're not appropriate and when they need to change.
The book is Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less from Dr. Ellen Broughton. Thank you, Dr. Ellen. And signature support for Talk Louisiana's from First Financial Tax and Accounting.